Suzanne Mazur is a doctor in Seattle, but she was born a New Yorker. Her mother played in the New York Philharmonic. Her dad was a musician, too, and they all lived together in Manhattan. Her parents divorced when Suzanne was a toddler and her sister just a baby.
You know, the rumor in our family was that my mom said, I want full custody of the kids and you can have all the other stuff. So the rumor was he took the cool apartment on the Upper East Side or wherever, Upper West Side, wherever we lived, and she got us.
The three of them moved across the country to Peoria, Illinois, to live with her grandparents. And that was the end of Suzanne's relationship with her dad. Even when she'd visit New York, there was no expectation that she'd see him. But Suzanne does remember her mother nudging her to visit someone else.
Hey, while you're there, you should look up your OB that delivered you. He'd really, really want to meet you. His office on Park Avenue, blah, 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 blah. This is his name. This is his phone number. Can you go meet him? He'd really like to meet you. And I was like, okay, yeah, Mom, sure, I'll do that. And then I never did that.
This was just one of those things that your mom said, something that teenage Suzanne was totally comfortable ignoring. It wasn't until decades later that her mother said something else that made it all make sense.
It was a few years before my mom died. So she had ovarian cancer. She was pretty sick. And we hadn't really, I mean, this hadn't come up because who would ask their parent like how they were conceived? And we assumed our dad was our dad. But she just said, you and your sister were both conceived by donor sperm. And we were like, well, how did you get this donor sperm? And she's like, well, I went to the doctor and I said, I really want to get pregnant. And he said, I'll be right back. And he came back with some sperm.
Now, this was the early 60s and a very different time when it comes to both medical ethics and reproductive technology. These days, there are sperm banks with huge donor catalogs searchable by every attribute. But at that time, there was just a conversation. In this case, a conversation between Suzanne's mother and her doctor.
She told me that she remembered asking for somebody Jewish and somebody bright. And so she was like, a Jewish doctor would work, something like that. But for that reason, she always thought it was him.
That's right. Suzanne's mother believed that her OB, the doctor who delivers the baby, was also the man who helped her conceive it. But Suzanne's mother never really asked any questions, and she died without knowing for sure. So put yourself in her shoes for a minute. How do you think you'd feel? Shocked? Betrayed? Grossed out? Well, not Suzanne. For her, this was the beginning of a detective story. And for the most part, the revelations along the way haven't been painful. They've been delightful. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is You Can't Choose Your Family. Can you? It's stories of family ties that go beyond blood, but still help define who we are and where we come from. Suzanne Mazur was in her 40s when she found out that she had been conceived using donor sperm. It was the first time she'd ever heard of it. I think a lot of us would be shaken by news like that, even angry. But not Suzanne, who figures that anger really isn't in her nature. Anyway, she'd never had a strong connection to the man she thought was her father, so it didn't feel like she was losing something. If anything, it had opened up a world of possibility. She decided to do a little digging, and she began to learn what it was like for someone like her mom, a woman struggling to conceive in the 1960s.
So first step was, I've tried to contact the OB who was responsible for the insemination, who is the person who my mom always thought was my donor. And he unfortunately had died. So the next step was I looked at my birth certificate and I found the doctor who delivered me. I was born over Christmas break, so my original OB didn't deliver me. I'm assuming maybe he was on vacation, so I got this other guy. So I found him and emailed him, and he actually wrote me back. We talked on the phone. He's in his 90s, retired, living in Florida. He told me as much as he could remember. So it sounds to me like New York City, there were a few centers where people would go with, quote, infertility. And in those places, the resident doctors could volunteer and get paid to bring a fresh sperm sample to an office on the day when an insemination was to occur. And it sounds like the resident doctors were paid about $35 a week. to work, and they'd be paid $50 a sperm sample. So it was like a really good moonlighting opportunity, which definitely would not be available in 2019, where there were some residents who really could make a lot of money this way if they chose to. There's a community of donor kids now, and I've talked to some of the women in that community, and some of them have found multiple half-siblings through this process because their donor was one of the residents who, you know, had a lot of desire for some extra money or whatever it was. So I realized that it would be really interesting and fun and just expand my world or refill my family to see if I have some half-siblings. So from there, I just sent in my spit to Ancestry.com and 23andMe, and it didn't really match me to anyone in particular, very closely, anyone that I didn't know. So your information just sits in their database forever, and I would get yearly, you know, emails from them, and I kind of forgot my password, stop checking it, all the things that you do, didn't renew my fee. And then probably was a year ago now, I happened to sign in and look at it, and there was somebody who matched very closely to me, and it was like either an aunt, a grandma, or a half-sibling. So I emailed her, and her name is Arlene.
My name is Arlene Hajinlian, which is the name I've had since I'm a baby.
And she had no idea what I was talking about.
Probably about 3 years ago, in fall of 2016, just out of complete curiosity, I did 23andMe. And I remember when it came back that I was 50% Ashkenazi Jewish. And I thought, oh, that's really weird. I'm like, I basically thought about it for 5 minutes. I kind of looked at the other information there and put it aside and really didn't think about it much at all. A year and a half went by, and I got an email saying there was a message for me on 23andMe, and it was a short note from Suzanne, and now I could see when I logged on there to see her message that she, 23andMe is saying that we're 25% sharing the same DNA, and I could potentially be her grandmother or her aunt.
I'm like, hey, listen, it seems like somehow we're related. What's your family like? She's like, oh, I had a mom and a dad.
I was born in 1953, and my sister was born in 1950, so it was two girls, Carol and I. And
we're 100% Armenian.
My parents were immigrants from Turkey, but we're Armenian, and we grew up, I grew up in a very sort of Armenian household.
And I'm like, oh, interesting, because in 23andMe, we match. And she's like, yeah, it's really weird, because it says half of my DNA is Ashkenazi Jew, but I'm Armenian, so that's really weird.
Oh, well, maybe it's not accurate, or maybe Armenians migrated, or I really didn't know what to think about it.
And it turns out that through a bunch of different things, including that she didn't match to her whole father's side of her family in her 23andMe profile, she started to realize that maybe something different happened than she had known her whole life. And both her parents had passed away, so she couldn't ask them what really happened. So she went back to a family gathering over Christmas time last year, and one of her family friends said, yeah, there was always a rumor when you were born that you were conceived by a sperm donor.
The cousin said, you know, I heard this story 30 years ago and I thought it was gossip, but it's fitting the story.
And she's like, ah, I think we might have something here.
Little by little, little pieces of information came to me till I finally realized, you know what? I'm a sperm donor baby too. It took me such a long time, not because I was denial or upset. I was like, I never suspected.
We met in April. We met up. I was in New York with my family on spring break, and we met up.
I was just so excited. I was so happy to meet her. I met her with her husband and her two boys at a Japanese sushi restaurant nearby.
We walked into a restaurant, and she was sitting there doing a like New York Times crossword puzzle, which is a thing that I do all the time. And she got really excited. She stood up and like started talking with her hands and like spilled her water. And I was like, yeah, we're related, definitely.
I was so excited to meet her. I guess I wasn't recording that particular thing. But I mean, I did feel very simpatico with her right away. And her kids were like, yeah, yeah, you guys are sisters. You both talk too fast. You both talk too loud. You know, we kind of have this way of joy of life. And I thought it was just fantastic. I just thought it was so cool.
So then she had been bitten by this research bug. And so she started contacting on 23andMe. You can see which family members you have in common with someone. So she started contacting all the people who she and I had in common. And one day, she threw lots and lots of research that I don't even understand, met somebody who was really, really into doing these family trees, and somehow connected the dots between her and me and that OB's original family. And we also figured out that that OB was a med student at the time when Arlene was conceived, at the place where she was conceived. So we're pretty sure, we're pretty confident now that we are related to him.
You're a physician, and you, I'm sure, have thought a lot about, you know, the ethics of all kinds of things that happen in healthcare settings. Do you think that what this doctor did, given the time and context, was ethically problematic?
That's a great question. I've thought a lot about that. I think it's hard to put yourself back in that time. I know a little bit about medicine in those days. For example, in the neonatal intensive care unit back in the early 70s, if a baby was really sick and needed a blood transfusion, the residents would just know whose blood type matched that baby, draw the blood out of the resident, and put it in the baby. And that was like a practice that happened all over the country back in those days. So it's hard. It's so hard to picture that because I literally have to go through a three-step process to get a Band-Aid now at my current job. But I think if you're looking through the lens of what people would do today and applying it to what people would do in 1969, that's really, really hard to do. And so that's a little bit unfair. So if you're thinking like, how could they do this crime? You know, at the time, it was just so much different. I mean, you can't put yourself back there. And then I guess trying to find the positive in it, like you're meeting these new people who you may not have met before. And there's always something, there's often something that's good that can come out of that.
Suzanne Mazur is a doctor in Seattle. That story was produced by Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. Hey, this is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're pondering whether you can ever choose your family. Up next is a story about a guy who built something, a business in this case. It was important enough to him that as he got older, he started looking around for someone to pass it on to. But in the process of settling on a successor, he discovered what he really wanted was a son. This story is set in the world of rare books, a field that seems to attract characters. Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman takes it from here.
What people remember best about Lewis Collins is his memory, what someone was wearing the day they met, what he ate for lunch while visiting another country. These details were stored in some sort of encyclopedia he kept in his head, right next to the thing that Lewis remembered best, books.
I would sit, you know, either in my house or in the coffee shop or in the bookstore, and I had a vision of all the books in the Bay Area.
This came from an interview that was filmed by a rare book trade group. Lewis has silver hair and the easygoing charm of a favorite uncle. His memory helped when it came to buying and selling books in San Francisco, which is where he ended up for a time in the 60s. Since he was a kid, Lewis dreamed of owning his own bookshop. That came true when he later moved to Seattle. Friends like Sybil James recall how he built a steady reputation.
He just was known as a good bookseller, a person who could find things for you, and a person that you could trust.
Then something unexpected happened. The internet. Suddenly, anybody with a computer could find books.
My value added disappeared immediately. I had nothing, so I had to like reshift, do everything, and then I'm competing with the goodwill to sell books on the internet.
He felt like an important part of the business was gone.
As time went, Lewis's interest in the book trade began to wane.
I know you've hoped at times to retire. What's the status of that?
I would retire out of the sitting in front of a computer, working as a glorified shipping clerk for Amazon. But I haven't figured out a way to do that.
Well, let us say that someone came along and bought your business.
Oh, I'd go out with a suitcase. I'd be very happy.
Except that last part, it's really a lot more complicated than that. We'll get to that in a bit, but first, let me tell you about another guy who was going through a rough patch. His name is Bill Wolf. You see, Bill was living in Seattle at the time with his wife and newborn daughter. He was making good money playing online poker. Then, the industry tanked. In 2011, a number of sites closed for reasons relating to fraud. Bill was looking to make a career shift anyways, but not on such short notice.
It was really hard. I have this memory of sitting on the floor, and I was just kind of despondent, and I was just like writing all over my pants with a marker, just, you know, almost in a trance, like, what am I going to do? What have I got myself into? I've got a 2-month-old daughter in the other room, and this is the worst time to be having sort of, you know, midlife crisis, career stuff going on.
Bill's a pretty reserved guy. So one of the few places he'd talk about his career troubles was at these dinner parties a friend would host. Here, Bill met someone whose life had also been turned upside down by technology. Lewis, the bookseller.
He would rant about the same things that I would rant about, but he came from personal experience of having lived in these olden times and me just suspecting that, yeah, we're going down the wrong track right now, and I wish we'd get back to the days before I was born when it was, when Coke was a quarter and stamps were a penny, and, you know, we bonded over our mutual cynicism.
The two were good friends when Bill found out something that changed how he looked at Lewis. It was at one of their dinner parties right before Bill left. He remembers stopping to kiss the host goodbye.
And then she sort of, you know, paused after the kiss and said, "So you know that Lewis is looking to pass on his legacy to someone, right?"
Let's unpack this for a second. Here's Bill learning through the grapevine that his friend Lewis, the same Lewis who said he'd happily retire, actually has plans to put him in charge of the book business. A complete left field moment. It took Bill a while to even process the idea. And then he just kind of forgot about it. Lewis never really brought it up. It wasn't until Bill left Seattle, moved back, and was looking for work that he got his first clear signal. A job working at the bookshop.
I didn't have any other great prospects at the time, and of course I love books and I love Lewis, so I said, yeah, definitely.
Bill got sucked into the business, first at the Rare Book Fair, then at the shop. All the while, Lewis kept dropping hints.
He would drop a comment, you know, "Hey, I guess, well, that's going to be your problem someday."
Keep in mind that nothing was in writing at this point. The idea that Lewis was going to hand over the business was just that, an idea, one that Bill still couldn't understand. And then there was another wrinkle. Lewis was looking for someone to take over the family business. Instead of grooming Bill, why didn't he just ask the son he already had?
We barely got along.
His name is Brian, and he lives in San Francisco. His relationship with his dad was pretty complicated growing up. Lewis left before he was born. The two didn't reconnect until much later, when Brian was an adult, over Facebook. When I asked about the book business, Brian was pretty blunt.
He wanted the business to prosper and do well. So clearly he couldn't have done it with me. That's just not going to work. I'm just the wrong person to do something like that. I'd sell all the proceeds and go to Mexico or something.
I only spoke with Brian for about 5 minutes. He kept trying to get off the phone in a polite way. I felt bad for keeping him in such uncomfortable territory.
Did you ever get the sense from Lewis that he wanted to, like, reconnect as father and son?
Yeah, not really. Nah. He wasn't very parental. He got that way in later years. He met little kids. It was then that he decided he liked kids. Not when I was little. There was none of that. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah. As I said, I'm gonna get. I got stuff.
At some point, Bill found out about Brian. It didn't take a phone call for him to figure out what was going on.
Here's a guy who had a son, didn't raise him, got to a point that he regretted how things had played out, and wanted a second chance.
Part of this made sense to Bill because he had his own issues with his dad. The two have a good relationship now, but they weren't always on the same page while Bill was growing up.
We would see him every 2 weeks or so for a weekend, and I got sick of going through those motions when we would just go with dad and, you know, sit on a couch and watch TV and really not be working to build any kind of meaningful relationship, let alone father-son deeper stuff.
So on one end, Lewis is looking for a son. And in maybe a less conscious way, Bill kind of wanted a dad.
So from that point on, that's when the destiny in all this really was solidified in everyone's minds.
Bill finally embraced his role as an heir to the business and started working alongside Lewis with this in mind. Now that everyone was on the same page, you'd think things would get easier. But that's never the way with family.
I remember the first year, we had completed the first book fair together. I came back in. I had scores of notes on everything, just tons and tons of ideas. And I was so excited to come in and show him how great of a partner I was going to be by, you know, just being involved and skin in the game and like really. And he wouldn't let me get the first few sentences out of my mouth before I could tell that it's just, this is a pointless exercise.
I mean, we used to say, you know, like he's our own personal curmudgeon.
Sybil James remembers the same thing about Lewis.
He knew we called him a curmudgeon, and he knew he behaved that way sometimes.
For years, Bill relegated himself to the background. But being ignored wasn't even the worst part. Remember how the two didn't have a formal agreement? Well, guess what? After 7 years, there was still nothing to say Bill would actually inherit the business should something happen to Lewis. Eventually, the pressure became too much. Bill quit. He put a letter of resignation in on Friday, knowing this would give Lewis time to think about things over the weekend. Come Monday, the two met in the store.
We've got this all this anxiety that's built all over the entire weekend, and now we're in the same room together, and it's like impossibly tense. And, you know, it starts in a nice, easy, sober way. Yeah, you know, I think it's probably best. And then, you know, it builds to a point where it really became like an out-of-body experience. I'm usually pretty calm demeanor kind of guy, but I just start really letting him have it.
Bill shouted about not being heard as a business partner. He dug in about there still being no agreement. In his own way, Lewis was receptive to Bill's grievances. After things calmed down, the two talked about possible ways forward.
And how this all formalized in the end is that he finally made a will 3 months before he died.
Lewis's family had a history of heart problems. One day last year, he left the shop to take his dog for a walk. Someone later found him unconscious on the sidewalk. He had a massive heart attack. Bill has been running the business ever since.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
This is Lewis's house. Well, actually, it's Bill's. After Lewis died, Bill took over the property, which includes the store. The whole thing is covered in boxes of books. I mean, really, you can't even see the kitchen floor. Apparently, things were worse when Lewis was around. Bill still can't believe that it's been a year since he died.
He presented something that, at least growing up, I don't feel like either of my parents were able to offer, which was kind of the whole package. It was obvious to both of us that whatever void there was in each of our lives, and for however long it lasted in each of our lives, we were able to make up for lost time by having that. We absolutely built a family here out of these missing parts that probably we all had.
For a brief time, those parts clicked. It didn't feel long enough. Bill still wishes he had more time to repay Lewis. But now he has other things to worry about, including a family of his own.
That story came from sound effect contributor Max Wasserman. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is You Can't Choose Your Family. Can you? A good way to picture Autumn Adams is in her crimson cap and gown. This was last spring as she graduated from Central Washington University in Ellensburg. And by her side were two people, her 14-year-old brother John and her 10-year-old sister Kaya. Nothing unusual about family showing up for a big milestone like this, but Autumn's family is a little different than the other young grads there that day with their moms and uncles and grandmas. Autumn's younger siblings have been there with her on campus for most of her college education. A heads up that this story has a few parts that might be difficult to listen to. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing brings us the story.
For being so young, 23 years old, Autumn Adams has already lived a pretty remarkable life, and we'll get to that. When Autumn got into college and started living on this campus of green lawns and quiet study halls, she knew she had achieved something that had been missing from her life for a long time.
I was thinking about stability.
At 19 and still figuring out college, Autumn became the legal guardian of her 7-year-old sister, Kaya. When this family of two first started living together in the dorms on campus, Autumn scheduled her classes to mirror Kaya's school hours. But one day, Autumn had a class, and Kaya didn't. Autumn went to her professor, who had a really strict attendance policy, to tell him she wasn't going to be there that day.
Well, what else can I do? And he was like, bring her with you. And that was kind of when it changed. And I was like, you know, maybe this won't be so hard.
A few months later, Autumn also became the guardian of her 10-year-old brother, John. Autumn studied anthropology. One of the areas that she focused on was legal anthropology, things like domestic violence and mass incarceration.
And in a lot of those dialogues, they don't talk about the children. What comes from those children? What do those children have to deal with as a repercussion?
Autumn can answer these questions for herself. She lived with violence and knows what it's like to miss a loved one who is in prison. Before things got complicated, growing up as a member of the Yakima Indian Nation, her early years were happy. She spent them with her maternal grandmother. Autumn would listen to her speak in her native language.
Ichishkin?
Ichishkin.
Ichishkin. Ichishkin. My mother's mom really took me under her wing and raised me while our parents were out being crazy. She used to love to yard sale, so I remember going and doing that. I got a desk one time. I don't know why, but I got a desk.
When Autumn's father went to prison, her grandmother took her to visit.
Yeah, we played Candyland and Uno. I lost both times.
After her dad got out, he and her mom moved back in together with the kids. Back then, it was just Autumn and her two younger brothers, John and Trent. Her parents fought a lot.
A few weeks before Christmas, my mom and dad got in a huge fight, and I had to choose which one I wanted to live with. And I chose my mom, and we left.
Her mom and dad met up briefly to give the kids their Christmas presents. Autumn asked her mom if she could spend the night at her dad's.
And I was told no. My mom said it was too late. I made my choice.
The next morning, a police officer showed up at school and took Autumn home.
They had found my father deceased that morning. He had committed suicide.
After that, the adults in her life, including her mom, got swallowed up in addiction. Autumn was taking on more responsibility, caring for her younger brothers. When Autumn ended up missing a few weeks of school, Child Protective Services came for the kids. They didn't know what was going on. A relative came to pick up Trent.
And so I had just laid them down to take a nap. And I was sitting there, and they came in, and they started dragging him away. And I could still hear his screams going down that hallway. And at that point, my biggest fear became losing my other brother the exact same way. And so we sat in that corner of that room, under the table. And I sat there with him in my arms. I didn't let him go.
Autumn and John stayed together. It would be years before they were reunited with Trent. Autumn was in and out of foster care for about 4 years. Then Autumn's mom got pregnant with Kaya. Her mom got sober for a bit, but fell back into drinking, and started using meth. By the time Autumn was in high school and back living with her mom, she got a deadbolt for her bedroom door and kept the kids in the room with her so they'd all be safe. Autumn remembers the sounds of her mother on the other side of the locked door, yelling and hacking at the walls with a machete. One day, Autumn came home from school, and no one was home. Her mom and the kids were gone.
So I was a senior in high school and homeless in January.
In Yakima.
In Yakima.
Autumn stayed with her cousins. Throughout all of this, including before her mom abandoned her, Autumn says that even though she didn't get the best grades, school was an escape for her and her siblings.
Because I would walk the kids to the bus stop, and I'd pick them up from the bus stop every day. I knew that they were safe, and that they were being cared for, and that they had food, and that they weren't going to have to deal with my mom alone. And so I also realized from a really early age that I'm having to live in a cycle. And if I want to break that cycle, I have to break the norm. My mom never graduated from high school. That was my first goal. It's just this intense drive to not end up like they did.
Autumn did graduate from high school, but didn't have a plan for what came next. At this point, her siblings were living with an aunt. Late in the summer of 2014, the aunt took the three younger kids and Autumn to the Ellensburg Rodeo.
Tonight, the Ellensburg Rodeo Queen, Julia Wickerman.
The rodeo is the highlight of the end of summer in Ellensburg. Children proudly look over the sheep and pigs they've raised, hoping for blue ribbons. Amusement rides toss people around in every direction. And there are information booths. Autumn and her family stopped in front of a booth for Central Washington University. Her aunt nudged her to apply.
My aunt walked up and she's like, "You should do it. You're just wasting your time sitting at home."
Much to her surprise, Autumn got in and enrolled for the winter quarter. Scholarships took care of most of the tuition. Her aunt, who was caring for the three younger kids, was fighting bone cancer. As her health got worse, Autumn's brother Trent went to live with his grandmother. Then Autumn took in John and Kaya, and their new life at Central Washington University began. The person who helped Autumn set up a schedule that worked well with the kids' school day was her anthropology professor and advisor, Hope Amazon. Hope welcomed the kids into the department.
There's probably a chair here that has glitter on it from it still, from a dress that Kaya wore like 3 years ago at a Christmas party. And every now and then someone will get up and they'll have, you know, glitter on their butt. And it's like, ha ha, you sat in Kaya's chair.
Like, I seriously consider Hope like my family. I built that here.
Hope says that having a student like Autumn in the classroom these last few years has been a gift.
I guess when I say that Autumn is someone who helps to transform that classroom, her perspective is one that comes from a set of values and beliefs and ways of sort of perceiving the world based on the teachings of her community and her experiences and how she values knowledge in different ways. And I think that causes students in the classroom who encounter that different perspective to reassess, you know, how they create sort of hierarchies of knowledge. Like, oh, what's in a book is the most important. Well, maybe actually what your grandmother taught you is the most important thing.
Ever since that one professor told Autumn to bring the kids to class, well, now Autumn brings them everywhere. When she went to academic conferences, she took the kids. Vegas, Washington, D.C., Hawaii.
What are we going to do today, Kaya?
Spending some of their childhood on campus, Kaya and John now have their own understanding of Central Washington University's anthropology department. They know who has the good stash of candy, who will let them draw with Sharpies without a second thought, and who might let them hold a spear that normally doesn't leave the corner of an office. Autumn is the first person in her family to graduate from college. She says that everything she does is for her siblings.
In the end, like, I'll be standing higher, but I'm clearing the way so that they could go even higher than I ever did. And that's going to continue for future generations. And it's also keeping in mind the fact that my ancestors survived, and that's why I'm here. So if they could survive genocide, I could survive this.
Autumn needs 9 pages to list out all of her accomplishments in college. grants, scholarships, research, student government, honor society. Now she's applying to law school. She's taking her brother and sister's wishes into consideration. Her brother wants a diverse cultural community, and her sister wants a place where she can learn how to surf. California is high on the list.
Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing produced that story. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is you can't choose your family, can you? Dr. Sam Blackman put that question to the test when he and his wife began the adoption process. Within a year, they were welcoming a beautiful baby girl into their lives. But here's what they didn't realize. It wasn't just their new daughter who would be joining their family. Sam told this story at Sound Effects storytelling event in June in front of a live audience.
I missed the birth of my daughter. I may have been in the lab. So I never had that miracle of life moment, that biological epiphany. I totally missed it. Interestingly, my wife missed it too. But Katerina didn't miss it. She was definitely there for it. She was 24 and living in a small town in north central Kazakhstan. 8 months pregnant, she had to travel to a hospital 60 miles away because there was no local doctor. And she had to sit in a room with three other women, no TV, nothing to do, waiting to give birth to a child that she knew that she couldn't care for, our child. In 2007, my wife and I peered into that room, and four different women stared back at us, and we looked away, embarrassed. And we went to the end of the hallway in that hospital, and we peered into a different room, and we saw eight metal bassinets holding eight newborn infants waiting to be adopted. And we stared awestruck because we knew that our daughter had been there. A number of weeks later, we had arrived in Kazakhstan. We had flown over after the end of a 7-month paperwork pregnancy. And a nurse had put into our hands a beautiful little girl, and we were in love. Strawberry blonde hair, bright blue eyes, covered in red spots. And as a pediatrician new dad, I did the one thing that I instinctively knew how to do. I stripped her naked and examined her from head to toe. I put my ear up to her chest and listened to her little heartbeat, listening for murmurs. I took pictures to send back home to everybody who was a geneticist. But in the end, all that I could find was a beautiful, healthy child, our child. A couple of months later, after living in Kazakhstan and spending time at the orphanage, we were awarded custody of her, and in this incredible moment, her birth certificate was changed, and they put her name, Annika, onto the birth certificate. They put our names on as her parents. And we flew back home to our home in Boston, and when we landed in the United States at Logan Airport, she automatically became a citizen. Now, I'm a scientist. I don't use the word miracle very often, but to go from paperwork to living in Kazakhstan, to having this beautiful little girl in our home in Boston in 11 months, well, that was our miracle. But what I didn't know at the time was that there was a hole in her heart, very small, no symptoms. We had no idea. But as she grew, the hole in her heart grew. And over the years, it got bigger And then one day it started to make her cry. You know, we'd always been very open with Annika about the fact that she was adopted. When she was three, if you asked her where she was born, she would say in her little girl voice, "I was born in Kazakhstan." And she knew that she had mommy and that there was a birth mother. But then one day, the penny dropped. "I was born in..." Wait a second. And despite knowing how much we loved her and how much we wanted her, she began to realize that somebody had given her up. And in those moments, that hole in her heart, that emotional hole in her heart, became symptomatic. And everyday childhood occurrences would begin to make her cry, cause these emotional infarctions. And she would cry out to us, "I miss my birth mother." And she would ask the unanswerable questions, "Why?" About 4 years ago, out of the blue, I came across an article in the Washington Post about a teenage girl who had located her birth parents in Kazakhstan and had gone back and visited them. And I thought to myself, could we actually find Katerina? I mean, could you actually find somebody in Kazakhstan 7 years later? I mean, look at a map. Kazakhstan is huge. And even if we could, what would we do with that? I mean, you can't just pop over to Kazakhstan. And beyond that, I asked myself, should we? I mean, what if Katerina wasn't the person that we had envisioned her to be? What if she wanted nothing to do with Annika? How would we be able to tell her that the deepest questions in her soul might never be answered? So you know what I did? I called the young woman from the newspaper article and I talked to her, and in talking to her, I was entirely convinced that we had to do this, that we had to search for Annika's birth mother, that we had to be able to help her answer these questions. We had traced her life all the way back to that room at the hallway, at the end of the hallway in the hospital. Now we needed to do everything we could to answer for her those last few questions, that why. And so I gathered all the information that we had about Annika, mostly documents in Russian and some pictures of her. And I wrote a letter to Katerina and we sent it to a tracker over in Kazakhstan. We didn't tell Annika that we were doing this. We didn't want to raise false hopes. And we sent this off. And about 4 months later, I got an email saying that they had found her. They had found Katerina. She was living in a small village about 100 miles away from where she had originally lived when Annika was born. And they sent us back a report with answers to a lot of the questions that we had. And they sent us back pictures. And for the first time in 8 years, Katerina went from being an idea to being very, very real. My wife and I debated exactly how we should tell Annika about this. And we decided to take her on a long weekend to a cabin in the woods on the Hood Canal. And one night we all sat on the porch as the sun was setting and the sky was turning pink. And we told her that we knew that she had wanted to know more about her birth mother and that we had looked for her and we had found her. And then I pulled out a brown manila envelope with her name on it. And then we gave Annika a missing chapter of her life. And it was one of those moments along this really unexpected journey where I stopped and realized that I have no idea what happens now. And I watched as Annika, our Annika, the little girl from the room at the end of the hallway in the hospital, our Annika, who was always destined to have that hole in her heart, our Annika, who needed to know why, opened the envelope. And she pulled out the report and she asked us to read it to her, which we did. And she pulled out the pictures of Katerina and she stared at them for a very long time. And then she was very, very quiet. She didn't cry. She didn't really do anything. And then with this preternatural calm, she turned to us and she said simply this. She said, "Thank you for getting me this information." And she gave us a fierce hug. And then she very carefully put the report and she put the pictures back into the envelope. And she tucked the envelope underneath her pillow. And later when we got home, she would take the picture of Katerina and she put it beside her bed with her most special things, magic seashells, a picture of her grandmother, the electric candle that she used to light when she was thinking of her birth mother. And in that moment, I saw Annika's deepest pain eased, and I saw the hole in her heart healed. And I saw Katerina reach out across 6,000 miles and 8 years and reach out and touch our daughter. And I saw in that the dignity and grace of the decision that Katerina made reflected in the dignity and grace of the words of my child, and I was forever humbled. I may have missed the miracle of birth, but in that moment, I witnessed a miracle of life. Thank you very much.
Sam Blackman is a researcher, physician, and storyteller in Seattle. You can hear more stories from our live event at knkxsoundeffect.org. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Max Wasserman and Sam Blackman. Special thanks to Paul Currington, John Kessler, and Kari Ploeg. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. Be sure to track down our podcast in all the normal podcast places and take a minute to leave your rating and review. We also love to get your feedback at soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week with the theme Folly of Youth. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.